Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Henry Ford is most often remembered as the man who put America on wheels by mass-producing and mass-marketing the Model T as an affordable car for common people. Our guest this week, however, argues that Ford played an even more crucial role, that of the visionary who first articulated a view of America as a consumer society of abundance. He's Stephen Watts, the author of The People's Tycoon, Henry Ford and the American Century. Following up on our discussion of Henry Ford, Fiona Beatty will join us to tell us about one of Henry Ford's greatest contributions to history education, Greenfield Village, and Rick Shankman will expand our historical knowledge even further when he fills us in on Orville Babcock, until recently the last high White House official to be indicted while in office. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. Mark your calendars. The United Nations has adopted a resolution designating January 27th as Holocaust Remembrance Day. Introduced by Israel and co-sponsored by some 90 member states, the resolution rejects any denial of the period in time as an historical event and urges states to develop educational programs that will instruct future generations about the horrors of genocide. The resolution also condemns all manifestations of religious intolerance, incitement, harassment, or violence against persons or communities based on ethnic origin or religious beliefs. Most of the buildings are gone, not that there was much to them anyway, when the first internees arrived in the summer of 1942 at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center, a World War II internment camp for Americans of Japanese ancestry located near Powell, Wyoming. The camp has been abandoned, but the memories remain, and now visitors can visit the site and take an interpretive walking trail that gives them a glimpse into life at Heart Mountain, where more than 10,000 internees were forced to live during the war. They were among the 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans forcibly removed from Washington State, Oregon, California, and western Arizona and sent to camps in the nation's interior. And also related to World War II, the official history of the U.S. Army in World War II has been published by the U.S. Army's Center of Military History. The volumes produced in the United States Army in World War II represent one of the most ambitious historical writing projects ever conducted. Popularly known as the Green Books, the series itself constitutes but a fraction of the historical materials available on World War II, but a broad foundation of records and recollections, carefully documented and annotated in the footnotes of each volume, makes the series among the most valuable resources for students of the war. The series has been published by the Government Printing Office. In case you're interested, the other services do not have anything directly comparable to the Green Books, but each has produced or sponsored a service history which covers World War II. The Navy's semi-official history of the war was published by Little Brown and Company in 15 volumes. The activities of the Air Force are covered in a multi-volume set by the University of Chicago, but it is now available from the Government Printing Office, as is the 5-volume history of the Marine Corps operations during World War II. That should keep you busy for a while, but don't go away. When we return, we'll be speaking with historian Stephen Watts about the people's tycoon, Henry Ford. This is Talking History. I'm pleased to welcome back to Talking History Stephen Watts, award-winning author and professor of history at the University of Missouri. Some of you may remember Steve when he visited with us a couple of years ago to discuss his book, The Magic Kingdom, Walt Disney and the American Way of Life. He joins us this week to talk about his latest book, The People's Tycoon, Henry Ford and the American Century. Once again, Steve's book has received glowing reviews. Library Journal described it as an exceptional biography of an exceptional man, and Publishers Weekly called it magisterial. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Great. And congratulations on great reception of your new book.
Thanks. It's always gratifying to know that people at least have some fondness for what you write.
Right. And you pick some great topics. Steve, tell us a little bit about this book. What is your approach to the subject of Henry Ford? It seems quite different from the usual business histories.
Well, in many ways, this is a standard biography in that it treats, I think, the chronology and big events in Ford's life, which was a very long and filled one, I should add. But it's also a kind of an examination of American culture, I think, from the earliest decades of the 20th century up to mid-century, and it explores Ford's impact on that culture as well. So it's a kind of two-pronged study, I would say.
Okay, a cultural study, to be sure. We'll get to that in a moment, but a large part of his reputation now is based on his business techniques. Let's just take a couple of the things that he's credited with other than mass-producing the Model T, and you can briefly tell us about those, and that would be the assembly line and vertical integration.
Absolutely. Very important topics, both of those. Ford was a pioneering figure, he and his engineers together, in the development of the assembly line. The response to the Model T was so overwhelming that they couldn't make them fast enough for consumers to buy them in the numbers they desired. So Ford and his people were looking at new production methods, and they were messing around with things and came up with this notion of bringing the work to the workers rather than taking the workers to the work, and invented the moving assembly line technique, wherein thousands of men would stand shoulder to shoulder, each doing a small task, and a completed car would come out at the end, created massive economies of scale and made it so cheap to produce mass numbers of automobiles, in this case, is that the price dropped dramatically. That took place in the early 19-teens. About 10 years later, at the River Rouge plant, Henry Ford used the principle of vertical integration, where he took raw products, iron ore, for example, and sort of came in one end of this massive industrial complex, and finished automobiles came out of the other. And once again, it created massive economies of scale and allowed him to drop the price even more for his popular automobile.
He's dropping the price, but at the same time, he's also well known for increasing wages, the $5 day, which was quite a change for that day. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was indeed a very important development, I think, in the development of the American economy. Ford, in 1914, had the revolutionary $5 day doubled the existing wage for automobile workers in his factories. Partly, it was a response to trying to keep men on the assembly line because the absentee rate was high, because the work was boring and unfulfilling. But in addition to that, it was part of something that plays an important role in my book, and that is a consumer culture. Ford, as he put it in his typically plain language, said that he wanted to be sure that the men who made the Model T could afford to buy one, and he thought paying high wages was a way to fuel along a consumer economy, which was something that he was very dedicated to doing in this period.
Okay, I want to come back to that idea of the consumer culture, but just to follow up on my last question, at the same time that he was willing to increase wages dramatically, he was opposed and did everything he could to block labor unions.
Well, he was. And one thing we need to remember, I think, is that Ford was well into middle age before he became successful. And by the 1930s, when the labor union movement is really exploding, he was an old man in his 70s. Unions cut across the grain of his very old-fashioned conception of an industrial organization, which was that the men would work hard for him and he would look after them, sort of the model of the $5 day. Unions he saw as a kind of alien institution that sort of wiggled its way into this process, and he didn't like it a bit. It simply ran across his notion of how this whole thing worked, and I think reflected in many ways that, in at least one sense, he was a man of the 19th century, I think, rather than of the 20th.
Yeah, interesting point. Let me take you back then. You already introduced the idea that your book is really about American culture, American consumer culture in the early years of the 20th century, or perhaps even the mid-years. But you write about Henry Ford, that he was the visionary who first articulated a view of America as a consumer society of abundance. What do you mean by
right.
that?
Well, I think the Henry Ford that we know from the textbooks and from grade school and high school and so on was a producer. He was the man who put America on wheels, Model T, going out to people, transportation, production, hardscrabble industrialist. All that's true, but I think that that Ford is actually a kind of pale reflection of the actual man, the historically significant figure who understood, I think, sooner and better than anyone that mass production depended on mass consumption. And when you look at the evidence and the documents surrounding his early life, what you discover quickly is that he had a kind of visionary idea, I think, that the consumption of material goods was what would make the mass of people happy. And I think what the Model T emerges as is not only a vehicle for transportation, but a vehicle for this new vision of the good life and carrying it into the modern world. Buying goods, consuming abundance becomes synonymous with being an American. And I think Henry Ford played a very large role in that.
Yeah, but despite all of that, his vision and his attempt to promote the Model T and a new way of life, he didn't embrace advertising.
Well, that's a good point, Brian. Ford was figure filled, I think, with ambiguities, historical ambiguities. He created in many ways, I think, the foundation of modern consumer capitalism, but he couldn't go the whole way. He held on, I think, to some old Victorian notions from the 19th century, even as he was doing that, and advertising was one of those things. He thought that he should make a good product, a cheap product, a durable product that people could buy, but he didn't want to advertise it because he thought that advertising was something that sort of encouraged people to buy something, whether they needed it or not, and they relied on all kinds of symbols and images in a manipulative way. And he didn't want any part of that. He thought that was deceptive, and it's kind of an interesting reflection on this creator of modern America.
There's a lot of ambiguities in here, because I also found it interesting that if he didn't want to promote or advertise the Model T or his automobiles, at the same time, he did quite a bit of cultivating of a folk hero image, which I assume is related to the title of your book, The People's Tycoon.
Absolutely, and that's another very good point. While Henry Ford didn't like advertising in an abstract way, he was very fond of advertising himself, and he became in many ways, I think, the first businessman as celebrity in American life, sort of the forerunner of the Donald Trumps and the Oprah Winfreys and what have you. Ford was constantly cultivating the press, magazine editors, newsreel producers, and it really became a kind of key mechanism, I think, for getting the Ford name and the Ford product in public consciousness. And he did become a kind of folk hero, I think, to ordinary Americans out there.
Interesting. But if you look at the darker side, for lack of a better way of putting it, of Ford's public life, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, his anti-Jewish crusade and his promotion even of the Protocols of Elders of Zion. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in the 1920s, Ford sort of went off on an ideological crusade that turned out to be a very, very unfortunate thing for his career. He was convinced that there was a Jewish influence in American life that was bringing about very, very bad results, and he created a newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, that became a mouthpiece for a kind of anti-Jewish crusade. And in the Dearborn Independent throughout the 20s, it was just filled with screeds against Jewish music and movies and influence in literature and business and on and on. And it got him into a great deal of trouble and really, I think, put a kind of indelible stain on his reputation that was richly deserved. He richly earned all of the trouble that he got into for all of this.
And is that the basis of his, let's say, less than critical view of Adolf Hitler during the 30s?
Well, that's kind of a tangled story in a way. Ford was part of the America First movement in the 30s. He was a pacifist, but that pacifism actually went clear back to World War I, where he had also opposed American entry into that war. But in the 30s, he joins with Charles Lindbergh and some other people to oppose American intervention there. And it wasn't so much that he was sympathetic to Hitler as he was opposed to war, but he did get into a lot of trouble when a representative of the German government in 1936 came to Detroit to award Ford a special medal and honor from the German government. Ford always loved the Germans. He hated the English. I think he had a kind of Irish background that kicked in here. And there were some really awful photographs of him wearing this medal in honor of the German government that made him seem like a Nazi sympathizer. The truth of the matter is, though, from the evidence I could find, is that Henry Ford was certainly an anti-Semite and a very dedicated one, but he was not a Nazi. I think that's going too far in the interests of fairness.
Did he ever back off from that position?
Well, he pretended to, I think, is the best way to put it. There was a lawsuit in the late 1920s that got to be one of these showcase trials. Ford actually threw in the towel before the thing ended and agreed to settle this lawsuit and signed an apology for his anti-Jewish positions and more or less said that he hadn't really understood or hadn't meant it. But the fact of the matter is that he just quit talking about it in public. In private, I think his anti-Semitism remained fairly strong throughout the rest of his life, actually.
Okay, let's drill down a little further into his personal life here and talk about his relationship, which I found interesting, with his wife, Clara, and the even more complicated relationship with his son, Edsel.
Absolutely. In many ways, Ford was a kind of old-fashioned Victorian gentleman, and he had a long marriage to Clara Bryant, a girl he had met from the surrounding farm area, village area, when he grew up. Very long and stable marriage, although there was at least one interesting diversion from that we could talk about later if you want. But a strong and stable marriage. His relationship with his only son, Edsel, was a tragic tale, I think is the best way to put it. Ford wanted his son Edsel to be a copy of himself, hard-driving, tough, shrewd businessman. And Edsel, in fact, was a very genteel young man interested in art and music, and he adored his father. Henry made Edsel the head of the company in the early 1920s and then spent the next 20 years basically subverting everything that he did and pushing the boy, trying to make him harder and tougher. Edsel simply internalized all of this, developed stomach ulcers, which mutated into a kind of cancer, and he died of that in his 40s, and Henry's heart was broken, I think partly out of guilt, because I think he understood at some level that he had not treated his only child very nicely for much of his adult life. So it's a very sad story.
It sure is. And the aversion you referred to, is that the extramarital affair that he had?
Well, it is indeed, and I think it's one of those ambiguities, I think, in this case, with a capital A in his life, even while having a long and stable marriage. There's a great deal of convincing evidence that he had a decades-long affair with a young woman who worked at the Ford Company, and that, in fact, he had a child out of wedlock, born in the early 1920s with this young woman. And it's a very strange scene. He put her and her husband, he married her off to his bodyguard, basically, and then put him in a kind of palatial home right next to his own home on the River Rouge, and they would go up and down the river to see one another. And Mrs. Ford apparently at least knew something about this and sort of chose to look the other way. So it was a very complicated situation.
Interesting. I think you've already hinted at the answer on this, but here's a man who lived in both centuries. Is that answer in part how he, the modern businessman, could also build Greenfield Village?
Well, I think so. As Ford moved into his later years, I think beginning in the 20s and then on into the 30s and early 40s, he became increasingly nostalgic for the world that he really had destroyed with the automobile and modern society. He builds Greenfield Village, which is a kind of recreation of village life. The 18th and 19th centuries, very idealized. Puts together the Henry Ford Museum, which collects antique items from these earlier ages as well. And it's very ironic to consider that the River Rouge plant, the biggest factory in the world, sits in a part of Dearborn, and about 2 or 3 miles away sits Greenfield Village. And Ford spends more time in Greenfield Village than he does in the River Rouge, and it indicates that kind of split sensibility, I think.
Interesting. Well, we only have a minute left, but let me conclude this by asking you to explain your statement in the book that Henry Ford was, all in caps, modern America.
Well, I think that Henry Ford, to my mind at least, was the most important creative figure in the making of the society and culture and really economy that I think we still have with us today. He would play an absolutely crucial role in creating the automobile, of course, which is at the cutting edge, I think, of our modern society in all kinds of ways. And even more importantly, though, he created this culture of self-fulfillment, which I think lay behind the notion that sort of meeting the desires of the self, in this case through consumption, through the consumption of abundance, is what makes America what it is in the world. And Ford played a very, very important role in that. So I think when all the dust settles, what you see is a man, I think, who is in many ways modern America personified.
Okay, well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. But thanks for joining us, Steve.
It was a real pleasure, Brian.
And I look forward to getting you back after your next book. And again, congratulations on another great job.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Stephen Watts, professor of history at the University of Missouri and the author of The People's Tycoon, Henry Ford and the American Century. This is Talking History.
Spring is here and summer is a-coming. The birds and the flowers and the bees are a-humming. The robin and the bunny and the little horned toad and millions of Fords are out on the road. My Ford, best buy, here's why.
Ford Step Ahead Engineering does it again. Gasoline saving up to 14% with three new Ford truck engines in the new 1952 line of Ford trucks. Ford pioneered the V8 engine in trucks.
As we just heard, Henry Ford is not only to be remembered for his mass production and mass marketing of the Model T, but also for his articulation of America as a consumer culture of abundance. Fiona Beattie joins us to provide yet another link between Henry Ford and history, Greenfield Village.
In 1912, Henry Ford began collecting agricultural equipment, power machinery, and everyday artifacts with the goal of establishing a museum and outdoor village. They were to serve twofold functions. The museum was to demonstrate the role of technology in America's growth, and the historic village, innovative for its time, to illustrate daily life as lived in bygone days with commonplace artifacts. The museum and Greenfield Village opened in Dearborn, Michigan, in 1929. They are a vast undertaking, well worth the visit. But if you can't make it there anytime soon, try the website for a valuable cyber experience. Virtual visitors can click on online exhibits such as Your Place in Time, where the five generations of the 20th century are shown chronologically with brief script and illustrations explaining how each were defined by the technology of their time. The war generation and radio, boomers, TV, Gen X and MTV. Click on museum exhibits arranged in categories ranging from agriculture, made in America, to the heroes of the sky, and view highlights such as the first John Deere tractor or a replica of the Wright brothers' plane. A special feature of Buckminster Fuller's 1940s round aluminum experimental Dymaxion house, restored and installed at the museum, is not to be missed. And why this futuristic white elephant drew the name Dymaxion, I leave to the curious, who should visit hfmgv.org/museum.
And finally, the recent grand jury indictment of Scooter Libby sent historians scurrying back to find the last high White House official to be indicted. Rick Shankman found him and is here to tell us what else he discovered. Shankman is the editor of the History News Network, an online resource on history, and the author of Presidential Ambition, Gaining Power at Any Cost.
Who was Orville Babcock and why should we care? Until recently, almost no one had heard of him. But he suddenly came back into the news after Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, I. Lewis Scooter Libby, was indicted. Orville Babcock was the last high White House official to be indicted while in office. That was a long time ago. Babcock served as President Ulysses Grant's secretary, in modern parlance, his chief of staff. They went back a long ways. Both West Point graduates, they fought together in the Wilderness and Spotsylvania campaigns. When Grant became president, Babcock sat at the desk just outside his office. Orville Babcock was well suited to the post. He was energetic and efficient. He had just one flaw. He loved money, and in the corrupt atmosphere of the times, he succumbed to temptation. Being a newlywed may have given him an added incentive. For 5 years, while sitting at Grant's side, Babcock padded his salary as a member of the nefarious Whiskey Ring, a scheme involving hundreds of people who cheated on the federal whiskey tax, which had helped finance the federal government during the Civil War. When Grant heard about the scandal, he growled, "Let no guilty man escape." But this was before he discovered Babcock was on the take. Loyal to a fault, Grant stood by Babcock. When Babcock's trial seemed to be going badly, Grant convened the cabinet to tell them he planned on going to testify in Babcock's behalf. Grant was deterred from this rash course, but insisted on giving a deposition in the case. It marked a turning point. Grant didn't just testify that Babcock was a fine fellow. The president said they were so close that he, Grant, would have known about the fraud had Babcock been involved, and he did not know. By putting his own honor at stake, Grant turned the trial in Babcock's favor. Babcock was acquitted. Grant asked him to return as White House secretary. This created a sensation, and Grant was forced to back down. But he let his trusted aide continue serving in the second of two posts he held at the White House, superintendent of public buildings and grounds. Babcock was indicted again in a scandal involving this other post later. Grant stood by him again. Again, Babcock was acquitted. Grant left office with a blackened reputation as an honest man who stood by dishonest friends. President Bush is no doubt hoping his story will have a better ending.
You've been listening to Rick Shankman, editor of the online History News Network and the author of Presidential Ambition, Gaining Power at Any Cost, published by HarperCollins.
Why you folks listen to what I say about a new Ford called a Model A? Or John Henry knew his bid when he said, "I'm gonna make a lady out of Liz."
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith, our studio engineer. That the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.